The squeeze on Iran, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. U.S. sanctions on Iran are intended to cripple the economy there. This business owner in Tehran is definitely feeling the pressure.
I'm not a criminal. I'm just trying to be helpful, to think about my business, about my people.
Also, a migrant detention center in Texas is under quarantine after a boy who was held there died from the flu.
Put him in a fenced-in area inside a facility where other people are sick, other people are coughing. You will see even more people getting sick.
Plus, a Filipino healthcare worker is paid next to nothing to care for the elderly here in the U.S.
I accept it. I have no complaint because I need to support my family in the Philippines.
Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It is pretty clear there's no love lost between the Trump administration and the government of Iran. Over the past few days, President Trump has been delivering a warning to Iran. Basically, don't threaten the U.S. or else.
With Iran, we'll see what happens. But they've been very hostile. They've truly been the number one provocateur of terror. We have no indication that anything's happened or will happen. But if it does, it will be met, obviously, with great force. We'll have no choice.
Iran's foreign minister responded to that on Twitter using the hashtag #NeverThreatenAnIranian. In recent weeks, U.S. officials have been talking up an unspecified threat from Iran. That's gotten pushback from European allies as well as Tehran. Yesterday, Acting Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan said the Iranian threat was on hold because of the tough talk from Washington.
We're in a period where the threat remains high, and our job is to make sure that there is no miscalculation.
American officials say they don't want things to escalate. But how is all the back and forth about a possible war with Iran going down in Tehran? The world's Shirin Jafari spoke with one Iranian businesswoman.
Leila Danishbar visited the UK for the first time in 2012, and she noticed something immediately.
I saw all these disabled people living their life freely, going shopping, having fun, and you could see them actually in society.
That was not what Leila saw back home in Iran. There, she says, most elderly people and people with disabilities are stuck at home.
There's no accessibility anywhere.
Sidewalks and crosswalks are not designed for them, she says. And often, they don't have the right equipment to help them navigate their daily lives. There are no reliable data on the numbers of Iranians with disabilities. But a Human Rights Watch estimate puts that number at 12 million. Out of a population of 80 million. It could be much higher. Some of that is because of injuries people suffered in the eight-year war between Iran and Iraq in the 1980s.
So we thought that if we start doing this for our people, one is a niche market in Iran, and two, we are helping our people.
Leila and her husband started a company that produces medical equipment, like wheelchairs, walkers, and mattresses that help prevent bed sores. Leila is the CEO, and she runs the company from Tehran. Leila says she was lucky. She started her business just as the U.S. and Iran were negotiating a nuclear deal. That deal would lift economic sanctions on Iran. In 2016, President Obama made an announcement at the White House, and towards the end of his speech, he said this.
Following the nuclear deal, you, especially young Iranians, have the opportunity to begin building new ties with the world.
That's what Leila was doing. After the nuclear deal, she partnered with a Swedish company.
We had a big celebration, and it was a big break for our company.
But her celebration didn't last long.
Today I am announcing our strategy, along with several major steps we are taking.
Last year, President Trump walked away from the deal. He reimposed sanctions. And how was Leila feeling about all this?
It's like suddenly you bump into a wall and you don't know how to climb it.
Leila lost the contract with a Chinese company, a major supplier of raw plastic she needed for her business.
And when I asked them, they said that we have a new American company who's purchasing the product from us. And they told us, if you have any connection with any Iranian company, we cannot deal with you.
She's reached out to a Turkish company now, but she's not sure if they'd be willing to work with Iranians, given all the pressure from the Trump administration. And adding to all the stress she's feeling is something even bigger.
The U.S. sending an aircraft carrier, warships, and fighter jets to the Middle East as a, quote, unmistakable message to Iran's regime. But so far,
there's talk of a possible conflict. Leila has been hearing all about it on the news.
It's scary. We had our childhood during the war.
It reminds her of the Iran-Iraq war in the 80s, when she was just a kid.
Some of the patients that I see, they are the war wounded. And still, we haven't been recovered from the last war. And I don't want, of course, any war for our people who are just recovering from the previous one.
Leila started her business to help Iran's wounded veterans. She knows well how long the wounds of war can take to heal. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
It's one of the busiest migrant detention facilities in South Texas, where immigrants sleep on mats on the floor behind chain-link fences. I'm talking about the Central Processing Center in McAllen, Texas. Customs and Border Protection officials there stopped taking in new migrants yesterday after identifying a large number of people in the facility suffering from flu-like symptoms. The move comes one day after a 16-year-old who'd been detained at the center died of the flu. The boy's name was Carlos. He was from Guatemala. Lorenzo Zazueta is based in McAllen, Texas, where he covers immigration for the Monitor newspaper. He's visited the detention center several times, including a trip last month.
The last time we were there, you know, you could clearly see that they definitely are over capacity at these facilities. They don't have the room to hold everyone that's coming in.
Right. I was just about to ask you, do you think there is adequate individual care, or is the sheer number of detainees just overwhelming the system to provide that?
That's right. The numbers that they're seeing on a daily basis, and this is what CBP is reporting, if you're looking at 1,100 to 1,500 people a day that they're processing and sending to the different facilities here. And recently we learned that they're shipping people to Del Rio and other places because of the lack of capacity here. If you're going to have groups of 1,000 and you only have so many medical staff, there's only so much that the National Guard people can do on that initial intake. There's only so much the CBP officer or Border Patrol agent can do in his capacity. So I think people who are in custody are being given the medical attention if they convey that they're feeling ill. But the issue that they're facing is that not enough medical staff, not enough personnel to handle the large groups of people coming in every day.
There's also just the number of seriously ill migrants that are ending up in custody that CBP officials say they're seeing. Like, some have chickenpox or the flu, the mumps. So how new are these developments?
That's nothing new. I know we like to focus on whatever the new wave is. And certainly here you do have an increase in the types of people that are coming into the country. So children being main component of that increase in numbers, their immune systems aren't as strong. And you're talking about sometimes 2 weeks, 3 weeks journey from where they're from to where we're at here in McAllen. Who among us wouldn't get sick during a journey that long? So it is true that some people are showing up and getting sick. And then you put them in a fenced in area inside a facility where other people are sick. Other people are coughing. And it's a cold, air conditioned, very cold facility. You're sleeping on the floor. You're eating maybe a meal a day. You're not getting all the water. So all of these things contribute to someone becoming sick. And if that sickness or that illness goes untreated for long enough, or the action's not taken that needs to be taken with that illness, you will see maybe even more people getting sick.
Right. So probably not too unexpected. What about the demographics of the migrants at the facility? How has that changed over the years? Like, are there more infants now?
Sure. You're definitely going to see more children in general. The increase in numbers that we're seeing is predominantly the majority of that, like 60% are going to be the family units, a parent and a child, and the unaccompanied children who are arriving by themselves. So the last time I was in a facility, that you do see mothers sitting off to the side, you know, nursing an infant, someone that can't walk.
Lorenzo Zazueta covers immigration for the Monitor newspaper in McAllen, Texas. Thanks for being with us, Lorenzo.
Thanks for having me.
A study last year in the medical journal The Lancet showed that there's no evidence that migrants spread disease in high-income countries like the United States. In fact, migrants are generally healthier than the host population. But these facts, it seems, are ignored by some commentators.
It's a health issue, too, because we don't know what people have coming in here. We have diseases in this country we haven't had for decades.
You're absolutely right calling this a public health emergency. That's part of the problem here. It's a big part of the problem, and it ties in with national security. Multiple diseases are coming in with the migrants.
Fox News commentators Laura Ingraham and Mark Siegel both speaking earlier this year. The trope of migrants spreading illnesses is an old one. Erica Lee is a professor of immigration history at the University of Minnesota. Her forthcoming book is called America for Americans, A History of Xenophobia in the United States. Erica, how prominent is this disease factor in America's history of anti-immigrant rhetoric?
It's absolutely been a driving factor throughout the centuries. We know that whatever immigrant menace was the focus of xenophobes in the past, whether it be Irish Catholics in the 19th century, then later Chinese and other Asians, of course, Italians and Jews and other Southern and Eastern Europeans and Mexicans, the claim has always been that these groups were not only racially inferior, but that they brought particularly dangerous and contagious diseases that would end up harming the U.S. native population.
You mentioned Catholics. I mean, I'm in Boston. Did all this start at the time of the Irish potato famine, 1840s?
Actually, it goes back even further. One of the first public health inspection buildings was set up in Philadelphia to process German immigrants during the colonial era. But of course, in the 19th century, with Irish Catholics coming in such great number, but also they were amongst the most impoverished and also, very ill from the famine, the potato famine in Ireland, they became the source of a great debate over their public health.
Erica, I know you've kind of done a lot of research on your own family history. Have any of these issues around disease ever kind of come up as you've gone back through the years?
Yeah, absolutely.
In what way?
My grandfather came to the United States in 1917 through San Francisco and was detained on Angel Island for 2 weeks. And one of the first things that he and all other arriving Chinese were faced with was an extremely humiliating and particularly invasive medical exam. The Chinese knew that no other group at Angel Island, including Europeans or Japanese or Mexicans, were being subjected to these kinds of examinations and were used as a cause or a reason for exclusion.
Travelers can spread disease, though. I think of Europeans bringing smallpox and other pathogens to the Americas at the beginning of the colonial era, or yellow fever outbreaks in the South in the 1800s. Just like intellectually, do you understand the fear?
Absolutely. Of course, there is an important need for us to identify individuals who are bringing contagious diseases. I think what changes and what makes xenophobia even more powerful is that it then gets applied to an entire group and it becomes racialized as something that's endemic to an entire population rather than individuals who should be screened and then taken care of.
Erica Lee, professor of immigration history at the University of Minnesota. Her book, America for Americans, A History of Xenophobia in the United States, will be out this fall. Erica, thank you very much.
Thank you.
A worker from the Philippines endures shockingly low pay to care for the elderly here in the U.S. That story's coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. There are thousands of assisted living facilities for the elderly in the U.S. It can be a profitable business, but not always for the caregivers themselves. Some make as little as, embrace yourself now, $2 an hour. Reporter Jennifer Gollin looked into labor abuses at assisted living facilities, especially cases involving immigrant caregivers, people like Sonia Deza from the Philippines. She worked at care homes in California run by Romel and Glenda Publico, a couple who own a chain of care homes. We're going to hear from caregiver Sonia Deza now in this excerpt from the story Jennifer put together for our partners at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting.
Hi, okay. Sonia.
Hi.
Hi.
We go now there.
I'd been talking to Sonia for months on the phone before I finally meet up with her in person at her sister's house.
How are you?
Good. Sonia came to the U.S. in 2000 after her husband passed away. She was here to look after her dad, who was already here, and she really needed a job.
Send money to the Philippines to support them, to support my family.
In 2012, she ran into Romel's sister.
And she said, oh, you want to apply to Romel? Yes, yes. I have no job.
So Romel hired her to be a live-in caregiver at one of his homes. She'd be one of two workers taking care of up to six residents.
My salary is only $50 in 24 hours.
That breaks down to $2 an hour. To put that in perspective, the federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. So by paying his employees what amounted to less than minimum wage, Romel was breaking the law. On top of that, Sonia says if she wanted to get that one day off a week,
you need to find a reliever and you'd be the one to deduct your salary.
Basically, she'd have to find someone to fill in for her, and then she'd have to pay that person out of her own pocket.
Because I need a job, because I don't have a job, I accept it. I have no complaint, because I need to support my family in the Philippines. Two daughters and two grandkids, yeah.
I met another woman who worked for Romel. Her name is Norma Lim.
My girlfriend referred me to Romel Publico. That's where I met him.
Norma goes by Normita. She met Romel and his wife, Glenda, in 2009. Normita says Romel is a real charmer.
Well, he's a sweet man, believe me. The wife is nice. Glenda, they're very sweet. He knows how to flirt. He knows how to grease on you. That's Romel. Yeah, you cannot get angry with him because he knows how to make you feel good. I had no complaint. The only problem is he tried to cheat us.
Before Normita met Romel, she was a professional poker dealer. But then she had a stroke and was left partially paralyzed. She wasn't sure what to do. She was in her 60s and she just didn't have a lot of options. Then she met Romel. And she felt like her luck had changed. He offered her the same deal Sonia had, $50 a day.
I'm kind of disabled and an old lady. Patients love my cooking, and I had no problem in the beginning. I was glad that I had a job.
So you were effectively earning $2 an hour.
Oh, well, I did not even think about that. Yeah, that was very low.
Normita loved the residents. They had fun together. They'd eat meals as a group and watch soap operas together in the living room. The house had lots of space, 2,500 square feet. But with up to six residents at a time, the work was relentless. It was like being the housekeeper, cook, nurse, maid, all rolled up into one. And if you listen to Sonia...
I woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning.
And Normita...
And prepare for the breakfast.
As they take us through their typical workday,
feed the six patients.
Their experiences sound nearly identical.
At around 7 o'clock, they have to clean to the bathroom.
And then after that, I clean up the kitchen.
Clean the rooms. 1, 2, 3, 4. 5 bedrooms there. You have to vacuum the floor.
Give them their medication.
You know, cleaning.
And then get ready for lunch. And then feed them. And then after that,
bring the patient to the, you know, the bathroom.
Clean the kitchen and then prepare for dinner.
The same routine.
I'm not really off because I stay in. You cannot sleep all night. I'm going to be calling, you know.
Help, help. You need to be patient to the patient.
All night long. Because
sometimes your patient is crazy. Sometimes they are fighting with you.
They make a mess in their bed.
We change the diaper. Yeah, every 2 hours.
Change them. Change the bed sheets. Clean them up.
Because we stay here, so we need to help our patient. This is our job.
And if one of the residents died, Normita says Romel would cut her pay by $100 that month. Were you ever allowed to leave the facility?
No, we cannot leave. I have to ask permission. He said nobody will take over, so.
She didn't even get Christmas off. Instead, there'd be a big party right there at the care home.
Christmas and Thanksgiving, holidays, we work. I'm telling you, no day off. There's no day off.
So you had this great connection with so many of your patients, yet you were exhausted.
Well, for me, I didn't feel nothing. Job is job for me, you know. I just take what they give, the owner give, you know.
Jennifer Gollin reported that story for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. She joins me now. We heard Sonia and Normita there describing working under really tough conditions for as little as $2 an hour. I mean, that last litany of chores Normita describes, that's the deal there. But why did they put up with the criminally low pay for so long?
These workers just don't want to lose their jobs. Many workers are routinely harassed or fired if they report this rock-bottom pay or overtime violations. And many of the caregivers in this industry are poor immigrants, and they are concerned about their legal status in the U.S., which means they're almost silenced into accepting these horrible conditions.
So, Jennifer, what compelled Sonia and Normita to finally speak out?
They're upset because they're owed thousands of dollars in back wages that they haven't received from their former boss. They feel really strongly also about speaking out for other caregivers who are entrapped in these jobs. And many workers just don't know their rights. They're new to the U.S., and they don't know that there is an actual minimum wage that they deserve.
What about the owners of the care homes where Normita and Sonia worked? I mean, how do they feel about these two employees going public?
Well, we spoke with Romel Publico, and he told us that he treated his workers like family. And he sees nothing wrong with how he treated his caregivers. At the moment, Romel and Glenda Publico, the owners of the care homes where Sonia and Normita worked, they're facing pending felony charges, including grand theft and tax fraud.
Well, it's a shocking and, frankly, it's a really complex story. Jennifer, thanks very much for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
You can hear the rest of Jennifer Gollin's story about assisted care facilities on Reveal, the podcast of our partners at the Center for Investigative Reporting. We'll link you to that at theworld.org. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. A hydroelectric dam in Turkey will soon flood a Kurdish town that's been inhabited for thousands of years.
Off in the distance are the square matching houses of New Hasankeyf, a city being constructed by the government to replace Salkan's doomed hometown.
The downstream effects of hydropower still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. A town in Turkey that's been inhabited for thousands of years is about to disappear, flooded out of existence. This town is in a largely Kurdish area of southeast Turkey, and a hydroelectric dam project there is expected to become operational this summer. The dam will generate power and provide water control, and it will create a massive reservoir that will submerge the town of Hasankeyf. Today, there are 2,500 residents living there, and as Duri Buskaran reports, they're getting ready to say goodbye as they wait for the waters to rise.
From her front door, Fatima Salkan can see everything. The Byzantine fortress crowning a limestone cliff, dotted with caves where her parents and grandparents once lived. Below, the Tigris River bends through an emerald-green agricultural valley. Off in the distance are the square matching houses of New Hasankeyf, a city being constructed by the government to replace Salkan's doomed hometown.
You see these old places as you see with your eyes, which is we are the owner, but today we are homeless.
Salkan's father built this house, all smooth white walls and flat roofs to double as outdoor living space, clustered around a central courtyard. She was born here, grew up here. Her siblings live here too, with their families. When she speaks, she slips easily between Turkish and Kurdish.
I will leave this place, and then I will go to the new place, which is nothing there, you know, like even no grass, no green, nothing there. What am I going to do there?
But Salkan will have to leave. At least that's what the government insists. Downstream, near the Syrian border, the Ilisu Dam is complete. When it becomes operational, likely this summer, it will flood the valley, submerging Hasankeyf and dozens of villages nearby. The Turkish government estimates that 15,000 people will be displaced in Hasankeyf and the surrounding villages, and many, including Salkan, say they were paid below market rates for their homes.
Hiç kimse razı değil kendime. Ama devlet işte biz elimizden gel.
We tried to do some protests, but we could not because they call you, if you do the protest, you are terrorists, guys.
In 2016, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan claimed that only members of the PKK, a militant Kurdish separatist group, and a smattering of academics opposed the dam. Ömer Güzel represents Hasankeyf in Turkey's parliament as a member of Erdogan's AK party. Sitting in a restaurant in the part of town which will soon be underwater, Güzel sees opportunity and a population that can adapt.
Şu andaki yerleşim alanı dışında buradan 8 tane eser taşındı.
8 different monuments have been moved out of the settlement, and they're going to make a culture park and open it for tourism. After this project ends, the castle will be open, and there'll be boats from the new settlement taking people to the castle.
Though the new city hasn't been completed yet, Güzel says he's confident that the residents will start to leave Hasankeyf in the coming weeks.
We were born and raised here, so of course moving somewhere else creates a bit of sadness. But this is a decision that's been made, and we have to respect it.
The $1.3 billion Ilisu Dam is part of a network of projects that the Turkish government hopes will generate electricity, irrigate farmland, and conserve water in the country's lower-income southeast, as climate change makes the region hotter and drier. Opponents worry that the delicate ecosystem of the Tigris River Basin, where some of the world's earliest civilizations developed, will be disrupted forever. And downstream, in Syria and Iraq, officials have raised concerns that the dam will cut off part of their water supply. Turkey delayed filling the reservoir last year during a severe drought. It's a short walk from Salkan's home to her orchard. We pass her elementary school, now empty. We duck under the gate, and we're surrounded by trees. Figs, apricots, hazelnuts, young grapevines climb a trellis on the north side. She planted this garden with her mother and sisters 25 years ago, after her father died. They'd make tea and sit here until late at night, swapping stories in the grass.
And we wanted this place to be green.
Every year, she says, she plants a garden of vegetables in the center of the orchard. But this year, she knew she would be gone before the harvest, so the dirt is bare. Isn't it difficult, she says, after all these years and all this work, to just leave? For The World, I'm Dari Buscarin, Hasankeyf, Turkey.
We've got photos of those ancient structures in the town that will soon disappear underwater. They're at theworld.org. As Dury mentioned, that dam is part of a massive project to control the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in southeastern Turkey. The two iconic rivers are also the lifeblood of Turkey's downstream neighbors, Syria and Iraq. Aaron Wolf is a geographer who's familiar with water issues throughout the region. Let's keep the focus on Turkey for a minute, Aaron. This is a project that spanned decades and successive Turkish governments. Why is Turkey so keen on this project?
Well, I think like a lot of countries that are developing, they need energy and they need to enhance the economy. And so these massive projects, the GAP project has 22 dam projects, and they provide hydropower, they provide flood control, they provide irrigation water. And so if you're looking to grow an economy, this is exactly the kind of thing a country might do.
Of course, there are also real environmental and social impacts, as there are pretty typically with big dam projects. How has the Turkish government responded to those?
Well, in the 1980s, the Ataturk Dam was one that really caught a lot of international attention. And a lot of criticism was geared towards a lack of good social impact assessments and environmental impact assessments. So at the time, the authorities really tried to do a modernization of their approach with really detailed public participation and social impact assessment and environmental impact assessment. Mm. So I think since that time, they've been pretty good as these things go. You can't build a dam without having certain negative impacts, but they've really upped their game in terms of development.
So give us the big picture here, because these are two of the region's great rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates, and they flow way beyond Turkey's borders. What's a 30,000-foot picture of the region? Like, what is the landscape like there?
Well, the politics of these projects are complicated, and I think they bring out both the worst and the best in countries. The worst is when a country tries to develop unilaterally, and that was seen the armies were mobilized between Iraq and Syria on the Euphrates in the 1970s when there was discord over a dam. So dams are often a stress point in conflict. But more recently, I think we're moving towards exactly what international dam building should be, which is collaboration and coordination. And Turkey and Iraq are coordinating. They've just exchanged high-level delegations to talk about more efficient water management throughout the basin. An upstream dam in Turkey can help with flood control in Iraq, can help with make sure that there's irrigation water downstream during the growing season. So ideally, there will be either a memorandum of understanding or they may sign a treaty to guarantee the terms of any kind of an agreement.
So finally, let me ask about the impact of climate change on all of this. We know Iraq and Syria are drying up. How is that making this whole big challenge of water in the region even bigger?
Well, it makes it the challenge more imminent. Climate change, especially in this region, can result both in less precipitation and in more rain over less snow. And both of those require thinking about storage. And so there's only a couple of ways to store water, and dams is the easiest in a way. And if they're done right, can have fewer environmental impacts than other adaptation mechanisms. So I think it really makes it critical that they're done in an environmentally sound way, in a socially sound way, in a collaborative way. But all over the world, even in a lot of countries that have stopped looking at dams, they're starting to look again because of the challenges of climate change.
Aaron, what is your personal connection to the Middle East, to the whole region and water? Like, how'd you get into this?
Oh, gosh. I kind of grew up back and forth between the Middle East and California. And in both places, water and politics are integrally intertwined. And in both places, it's easier to talk about water and get to politics than it is to try and tackle politics head on.
Aaron Wolf at Oregon State University. He works on transboundary water issues in the Middle East. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco. Appreciate it.
There's a thing going on with milkshakes in the UK this week. A few milkshakes have been thrown by Brits showing their disgust at pro-Brexit candidates for the European Parliament. Vanilla milkshakes especially. Anyway, EU parliamentary elections begin tomorrow and run for a few days. First up are the UK and the Netherlands voting tomorrow. The Netherlands is a good example of what's at stake in these elections, with far-right and Eurosceptic candidates predicted to do well. So should Europhiles be worried? From Amsterdam, here's the world's Orla Barry.
The Netherlands is no stranger to populist right-wing politicians. There was Pim Fortuyn, who was assassinated in broad daylight while out campaigning in 2002. There was Geert Wilders, who has linked Muslim refugees with terror attacks. Now there's Thierry Baudet. Here's Baudet declaring victory after the recent local elections.
We worden ondermijnd door onze universiteiten.
Baudet tells his supporters that Dutch people are under attack and Dutch culture is being undermined by universities and people who receive art subsidies. Most of all, he says, the Netherlands is under attack from its own political leaders. Thierry Baudet is 36 years old. He's written steamy novels and he rails against the news media and the European Union.
He's very extravagant. He's flamboyant in the way he dresses, the way he speaks.
Sarah de Lange is a political scientist at the University of Amsterdam.
He has, for example, appeared in Parliament for a debate about defence policy dressed as a soldier. He recites Latin when he's speaking in Parliament. He's an avid social media user, posting also controversial pictures of himself lying on a piano or naked by a swimming pool.
For many years, Thierry Baudet has been virulently anti-EU. As a newspaper columnist, he promoted an exit, the Netherlands' equivalent of Brexit. Baudet's party is called Forum for Democracy. The party is pushing for a referendum to ask the Dutch public what sort of EU membership it wants.
Now, there's two problems with that. One is that the Netherlands has abolished the referendum altogether. And the second is that support for EU membership in the Netherlands is above 70% at the moment.
Like most far-right parties, Forum for Democracy has strong views on immigration. This week, Thierry Baudet retweeted an anti-immigrant video by a far-right German women's group. Previously, he referenced fears of a, quote, homeopathic dilution of the Dutch population as a result of immigration. Baudet's party colleague, Dirk-Jan Epping, who's also running for the European elections, says, like most journalists, I'm misquoting his party leader.
It is the dilution of culture, is what he has said. And this has been changed, so it seems that it is against the people. But it's the Dutch culture that will be watered down and could evaporate if there are many people from different cultures that do not abide by the Dutch constitution.
Jan Epping is referring mainly to ethnic Turks and Moroccans who live in the Netherlands. That would include writer Abdelkader Ben Ali, who emigrated from Morocco as a child. He says the 9/11 attacks changed attitudes in the Netherlands.
People would ask me, what do you think of Al-Qaeda? Are you for terrorism? Suddenly you were put in the position of the bad guy.
Even though you're Moroccan background.
Yeah, American background, but because, you know, I'm Muslim background. So suddenly everyone who was a Muslim became a bit suspicious.
While the polls showed the Forum for Democracy party is attracting new, younger voters, Forum's voter base also skews male. There's a clear reason for this. Leader Thierry Baudet has been talking about women for a long time.
Yeah, Thierry Baudet has been an anti-feminist for over a decade. And he has published a lot about what women apparently really want.
Mark Liefese Arianza is a political reporter with the Dutch newspaper NRC Handelsblad.
Which, according to him, women say no, they mean yes. They want to be overmanned, according to him. They want to be dominated by men in every possible way, both sexually and socially.
So just how successful are Europe's far-right parties, like Forum for Democracy, likely to be in the upcoming elections? Jan Epping believes they will mirror the success of Donald Trump.
He's doing very well. What does that mean for Europe? And for us, the lesson is that we see a similar movement in Europe, the movement of what I would like to call the forgotten people. So I think that the wave we have seen in the United States will be translated into a wave we'll see in Europe.
And maybe the first test will be tomorrow's elections for the new European Parliament. For The World, I'm Orla Barry, Amsterdam.
A decision is coming this week in Kenya on whether the country will legalize gay sex. And on the eve of that court decision, one of the country's most prominent gay rights activists has died. We remember writer Binyavanga Wainaina, just ahead here on The World. Hey there, World podcast listener. We're creating a newsletter to help keep all of you up to date with everything we're doing in The World's newsroom. We want you to tell us what you think would be most interesting, most useful for you in a newsletter from The World. So I'm looking at you superfans to help us out and be a part of The World's newsletter focus group. I know you are some of the smartest listeners out there, so your input will be really important to have. Don't worry, it won't take a lot of time. Just send us an email to myworld@theworld.org and write newsletter in the subject line. That's myworld@theworld.org. And thanks. Today, we remember the Kenyan writer Binyavanga Wainaina. He died last night, 48. Wainaina taught journalists and writers in the West how to think differently about Africa, not just a place of military coups and famine and dead elephants being harvested for their tusks. It's a nuanced place. And, you know, even myself, I spent 6 years in Africa, and reading some of his essays, I realized I was falling into some of the same traps. In 2005, Wainaina wrote maybe his most famous essay, a mock tip sheet for Western journalists called How to Write About Africa.
Always use the word Africa or darkness or safari in your title. Never have a picture of a well-adjusted African on the cover of your book or in it, unless that African has won the Nobel Prize. Never, ever say anything negative about an elephant or a gorilla. Elephants may attack people's property, destroy their crops, even kill them. Always take the side of the elephant.
Wainaina also wrote a beautiful memoir in 2011 called One Day I Will Write About This Place. He transported you to Kenya in the 1970s to three kids playing soccer.
I stand still between the metal poles we use as a makeshift goal mouth, watching Siru and Jim play. Random sounds fall into my ears. Cars, birds, black mamba bicycle bells, distant children, dogs, crows, and afternoon radio music, Congo Ramba. People outside our compound are talking, in languages I know the sounds of, but do not understand or speak. Luya, Gikuyu.
Yeah, I can feel it. 4 years after Waneno wrote that book, he did something extraordinary. He released what he called a lost chapter from that memoir. He imagines a conversation with his dying mother, where he tells her he's gay. With that essay, he became one of the first high-profile Kenyans to come out. I spoke with him shortly after that.
That piece was written at a moment when I wanted to throw myself in a place of love, when very dangerous things seemed to be looming for gays and lesbians in Uganda, but in particular in Nigeria, a country I love and visit a lot.
Now, in this essay, you imagine coming out to your mother as she lays dying, and that actually never happened, right? Did you ever have a chance to speak to your mother about your sexuality?
No. And I didn't get a chance really to see my mom in the last years of her life. You never really prepare to lose your mom. You always think that they're sort of, you know, eternal.
And the essay, was that kind of what you wanted to say to her?
Yes, that was what I wanted to say to her. I guess if you lose parents and you're always having these conversations with them.
What do you think she would make of your announcement that you are gay?
She'd be in the sitting room, I think, in the living room, watching TV. My dad would be coming back from golf, waiting for supper. She'd be like, oh, Kenneth. And then she'd go and pray, and she'd probably call her pastor. And when my dad comes, she'd look at him, his face would go stony. My mom, usually when she was angry with me, would be quiet. So I'd kind of wait a couple of days before I called her, and she'd say something like, sit down.
Do you think she would be proud?
I think she would have to come to a journey to being proud. My mother never asked me if I had a girlfriend, right? But she never encouraged me to have a boyfriend. You see what I'm saying?
Mm.
So there's something that she knew, and, you know, in that innate way mothers know, and it's something that she was always fiercely protecting me from. And so that question never arose, ever. You're left imagining, yeah?
Less than a year after our conversation, Waneno had a stroke. And a year after that, he announced that he was HIV positive. So now Kenya is at this moment where the Supreme Court, this Friday, is poised to make a decision on whether or not to legalize gay sex. Binyavanga Waneno was one key player who paved the way for that. And I can't help wondering and thinking how much more he could have accomplished and changed for Kenya if he had lived longer. By the way, earlier we heard Ivano Jeremiah reading from the audiobook version of One Day I Will Write About This Place. Okay, take home DNA tests. People get their saliva analyzed for lots of reasons, to find out about their family history, connect with long-lost relatives, and apparently to plan their vacations.
How would you feel about taking a journey based on your DNA?
It's called DNA tourism or heritage tourism. Yep, you spit in a tube and they tell you that you're 30% from this part of the world, 20% from that part. And based on that, they suggest where you should travel. You can even get travel discounts as part of the deal.
We did a DNA test to prove it and turn those results into discounts. The more Mexican they are, the more discount they get.
An ad from Aeromexico and Ancestry.com earlier this year. And they're not the only ones partnering on heritage tourism. This week, Airbnb got into the mix. It's teaming up with the DNA testing company 23andMe. You give them your data, they'll tell you where to go, where to stay, and help you get in touch with your roots, or so they say. What we here at The World want to know is, have you done any heritage vacations or DNA tourism, whether through a company or on your own? Following a family tree or an oral history, what was your experience like? Was it worth it, or did you regret it? And even if a DNA-guided vacation isn't on your bucket list, what do you make of all this? You can answer those questions on a form pinned at the top of The World's Facebook page. We'll share some of your stories next week here on the show.
Tambo, tambo, tambo.
I've been wanting to play something from this album ever since it came out a few weeks ago. A West African singer, Angélique Kidjo, and her homage to a Cuban legend, Celia Cruz.
Porque siempre está.
Elegua is the title of this composition that Celia Cruz made famous. Elegua is one of the deities in the Santeria religion. When Angélique Kidjo covers it, though, it echoes the places she's traveled to in search of her own heritage and musical inspiration. Cuba, but also Brazil, where Santeria is known as Candomblé. That all boomerangs back to Kidjo's roots in Benin in West Africa, where the Yoruba people practice this religion before slavery took it to the Western Hemisphere. Tambo, tambo, tambo. It's worth noting, too, that Angélique Kidjo now makes her home in New York City, where Celia Cruz also settled. And given the importance of Nueva York and Latin music, it, too, is part of Kidjo's cultural journey. Elegua from Angélique Kidjo's new album titled Celia. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I feel compelled to shout Azucar, but I'll just say goodbye until tomorrow.
Public Radio International.